Hello and welcome to Startup Kitchen Talk, where we discuss startup apprentices becoming master chefs. Thank you, audience, for being with us. Special thanks to Mr. Jalul Senior, who I was told will be definitely tuning in and who happens to be the father of our today's guest, William Jalul, the founder of startup Flowplay.
Hey, good to see you today.
Thank you for being with us. You told me that your dad is listening to all of your interviews and reads everything you write. Is that because of your startup, or would he be doing that neither way? Like, even just imagine that you would become a carpenter and this podcast would be Wood on Lie or Carpenter Kitchen Talk. Would he be listening to that interview as well?
Ooh, that's... Well, I think if it was regarding entrepreneurship, he would for sure be supporting me in any business I do. Of course, like my dad's kind of history, he originally did want to be a banker. So something to do with finance is very close to him. So I think he's... But much happier that I'm doing something in the financial world than being a carpenter.
Yeah, well, carpenter daily must wait in that case. You also said to me that you were and you wanted to be an entrepreneur your whole life. So what was your first trade? Was it lollipop for a dummy, or what was it? Do you remember?
I didn't have like a side hustle that I would do kind of, you know, like what these other founders do when they were younger. I didn't really do that. I kind of started working very early. Maybe it was not even just an entrepreneurship, like working in my dad's factory. So because he worked in the glass industry. So I already remember when I was like 12 years old, 11 years old, and I would be sent to the warehouse and I would kind of pack things together. So it was more about kind of learning and appreciating work and as well, you know, cutting the grass for the family. We had a big garden at our country house. I would have to go and do that every weekend. So kind of, you know, just getting my hands dirty. But I wouldn't say I had, let's say, a side hustle or doing, you know, trading things or selling, you know, lemonade in a stand. I didn't really have that when I was younger.
And did you ever have respect of the workers when you were sent to deal in the company?
100%. I always kind of felt that, you know, respect others, and I would never kind of look down upon others for having, let's say, working in a warehouse or something like that. And that's kind of maybe because I got to experience that work very early on, and that that really helped me kind of appreciate what everybody does is incredibly valuable.
And would you, on that, I feel that it's very important and you had the experience to get your hands dirty, you know the feel, to try from the warehouse to selling some parts of the company, etc. Would you trust an entrepreneur who never had that in their life? It's like a first-time founder, but no experiences of any of that hustle before.
I would say, you know, like everybody is different, right? You know, not everybody has to gone through so much experience to be able to start. Like, I just support anybody who does even just try, and even taking the risk of becoming an entrepreneur and taking that step forward is a huge risk and needs the guts to do that, that I respect just the fact that they're doing that. So it's not that like, oh, it's their first time founders, I trust them less. No, I respect even first-time founders because it just takes so much, pardon my words, balls to go ahead and do that.
So you don't trust, like, or do you just protecting a child with a gold cage and you, instead of them, push them to have some of that experience when they are a teenager or something?
Yeah, like I would have for sure. I just am freshly a father, actually, 19 days today. And I 100%, you know, like kind of feel that you want to take them and show them the world, you know, because protecting them and having a, you know, a golden egg and then protecting them from life is not the best way to go. So really opening them up to the world and having them taking risks and failing, because, you know, one of the biggest things that I really support is that everybody should experience failure, because that really builds character. But it also, you learn from those mistakes and you can become better if you go through it and you actually make mistakes. So just trying out and going and failing is a huge opportunity.
And at what age did you realize that the banking systems kind of suck for the small and medium-sized businesses?
Well, myself kind of experienced that, you know, I kind of wanted to work in finance for a long period of time. At one time before when I was, so I knew since I was 14 years old, I wanted to be a kind of an entrepreneur.
Why specifically 14? What happened at 14?
So at 14, it was my father's kind of business failed. It bankrupted and we actually kind of lost everything we had. But even through this kind of negative experience, I still thought that entrepreneurship and being an entrepreneur was the way I wanted to go forward, because you're responsible for your own time. You actually build what you believe you are building, even though, as I said, you know, you can go through bad times, and but I think bad times kind of make you become better. If you learn from them, you can evolve. So I really just knew at that time, even though this happened to us and I saw it firsthand, you know, my father's business not succeeding, I still believe that I would want to be an entrepreneur one day.
And this is the way to go. Yeah.
Exactly. And I myself, when I was kind of then later and around my 70s, I was thinking about maybe I could be an investment banker. Mm-hmm. That was a kind of an idea and a thought there. But then I was just decided that I wanted to become an entrepreneur. And I started working in finance and financial consulting. And there I built a company. And through that time, I met with thousands of companies, small businesses, where I kind of was helping them kind of with all kinds of things, financial, but mostly kind of access to capital. And just the process that I experienced and dealing with the banks was just so horrid. I already then, and this was in my early 20s, I knew I wanted to do something about this and change this one day.
And was it the arrogance or the system? People, everything. What was, if you should pinpoint the most crucial things?
So it was a combination of all of those things. It was not just, I would say you kind of said it correctly. In a way, the arrogance is as well, because these financial institutions, they're kind of gatekeepers to this capital. But unfortunately, the people at these institutions have never been entrepreneurs themselves. And therefore, you know, they don't actually understand what the entrepreneurs
maybe
need.
They didn't work in the warehouse and didn't, you know, take care of the grass at the house, etc.
That could possibly be it. I don't want to underestimate them. I believe, you know, individually, the people there are not trying to do bad, and it's not something they're doing intentionally, but it's just the lack of the system that's being set up, kind of created and evolved them, that these people in the institutions have a sort of arrogancy that they know best. And even though they've never sat on the other side. So the products that are built and they're created are just not fitting the real needs of the entrepreneurs and the small businesses. And I met with this on a day-to-day basis when I was working with the small businesses. As I said, you know, thousands of companies day-to-day, analyzing their tax returns, going to the banks, waiting for 3 months and getting a no thank you when they were looking for capital because they didn't fit the check boxes that the banks predefined, because that's how they think a business should be run, which they look at it. It's completely different if you're running a business with 3 people or 100 employees business. It's completely different. But in a lot of aspects, they look at it the same way.
Like the issue before Christmas that needs like a loan for a month or two to get there to fill their stock and make the money later, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. There's, you know, these small entrepreneurs and, you know, they need flexibility. You know, things change day to day, month to month. So, you know, what was true 3 months ago is completely different today. And that's really, like you said, you know, before Christmas, there's the peak of their, you know, of their season. They need to pre-stock somewhere at the end of summer, you know, need the capital, but they don't need to take a loan for 5 years or 3 years. They need short term. They need to buy the stock, sell the stock, repay the loan, and then maybe go again. And then maybe January, February, start preparing for another peak of their, because they have, you know, different times and different seasons. Every kind of e-shop is different. But that goes for any type of business. It's just not in e-commerce. And this flexibility is really important to the entrepreneurs. And if I were to kind of define it, the three priorities that entrepreneurs really and small businesses care about is, you know, they need speed, they need simplicity, and only on the third place do they really worry about like, okay, how much is it going to cost me?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, because they believe in their entrepreneurial kind of capabilities and they know their business. So they really focus. They just need the speed and flexibility and kind of simplicity of their of the product versus kind of this complex processes with financial institutions where it can take like 3 months to apply for a loan.
And you saw that like a complex problem, not just a Czech problem, but the European one.
And this is, yeah, it's not just, not even a European one. Mm-hmm. I think this is a global problem. Like we've all heard about, you know, small businesses being the heart of the economy, yeah. right? You
know, heart of the country.
Of exactly, you know.
The backbone of our state.
Very true. And it's not just for the fact, you know, on an economic level that, you know, they add so much value on GDP, employment, you know, but also on a kind of a socioeconomic mm-hmm. level. So, you know, they really support their local communities. They're much more involved. They, you know, create the middle class, the upper middle class, which they drive innovation as well. And all of these things are so important, yet they're left behind. Like we've got finance, like big corporates, which are, say, too big to fail, which can get endless capital yeah. fundamentally.
And incentives.
And incentives, exactly. They can, you know, from lobbying, you know, all kinds of things that are just being preferentialized. And sometimes even these companies should technically not exist anymore because mm-hmm. they're strategic companies and therefore they're, you know, kind of artificially being kept alive, which is at the end of the day, I believe, causing more problems than good.
Yeah.
Because if you let them fail and actually restructure or let these smaller businesses then grow to become bigger ones, and that is... It's actually good. It's good. It's healthy for the economy. You know, things have to change, kind of evolve. It's, you know, like the cells in the body, you know, they die, they regenerate. You know, it's it just things have to keep going ahead and ahead. And it's part of life. And this obsession with failure we have mm-hmm. is wrong. Like, as I said, you know, I wish everybody, every entrepreneur to fail at a certain point. And to fail big, to fail small, is, I think, really healthy for an entrepreneur because you can learn from that and you can become better. And that's really important.
So what did you decide to do with that? You saw an opportunity and then what?
Yeah. And this opportunity I didn't mention was that if I put into numbers, Europe has a funding gap. This is, there's mm-hmm. an analysis of this, like how much capital small businesses should be eligible for, but they are not able to access it is 400 billion euros.
Based on what criteria?
So these are, you know, small businesses that are growing, that have...
Yeah. They're healthy.
They're healthy companies. Yeah. They're not failing companies, mm-hmm. but these are actually companies, but they just don't... But there's certain limitations. It can be... this funding gap is a mix of, you know, debts, of equity, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of basically not having the right contact or mm-hmm. access or don't even know how to access it properly because the system is not set up to really support them and help them access this capital. And if I take it on a global perspective, there's some statistic to talk about $8 trillion as a funding gap. So it's not just a problem of Europe, but it's literally a global problem. And this is causing, of course, another aspect, and that's kind of, you know, a gap not just in funding, but in a wealth gap. Because, you know, wealthier are becoming wealthier, the kind of the middle and lower class are sometimes being left behind, which is kind of creating bigger and bigger scissors.
Yeah, because the states don't think that the eShop before Christmas is the crucial vertical to be supported, right? Maybe. So let's talk about the startup because you saw an opportunity and you just didn't want to just to criticize it. You wanted to do something with that.
Exactly.
How was it to because you are very famous for your how should I say modest and small ambitions. Only you want to become the biggest fintech of Europe, surpassing Revolut, so really, you know, becoming a unicorn soon, etc. So how is it to build something like that from Czech Republic?
Well, humble. I would say. In a way, I kind of why I believe this is because I believe it is such a big problem and it is so important. And I'll be right now in a bit like selfish, right, as well. Like, so I want to live in a better world. I really want to live in a better, like, environment, everything around me, and I want people to be happy, you know, and being able to succeed, you know, and move forward.
And healthy middle class.
And a healthy middle class, because that's super important. And that's, like, the most greediest thing for me is for me to live in a safe environment, to live in a safe community, to live in a world that's prospering. I believe you really need to have a strong, you know, middle class and this kind of strong kind of entrepreneurial class, more importantly, because the entrepreneurial class is not only about creating value, but, you know, you have kind of they're responsible. They're right. They define themselves. So they're not saying, OK, the state will take care of me. They know they have to take care of themselves. So, and I think in a world where everybody kind of thinks, OK, I know I have to take care of myself, but that means that I have to support the people around me and my communities, then it's a better world for me as well, because I want to live in that world. And so for me to be able to support them, of course, simultaneously, I'm an entrepreneur and I also want to make profit. And I want to make a business worthwhile. And I see this problem is so massive and we've been talked about for decades, but nobody has really actually fixed it yet. Nobody has fixed this problem to date. And it's just getting bigger and bigger every year. And so I believe I can fix this, and I believe I have the right approach, the right team, the right strategy, and the right understanding. Because not only was I supporting these small businesses, but I ran the small businesses myself. I ran them. I dealt with the banks on a day-to-day basis. So I know exactly what those businesses need. So I just want to, through my own entrepreneurial experience, build something for them. And simultaneously, because the market is just so massive, build one of the biggest companies in Europe.
And how do you explain yourself that if it's, you know, you mentioned 8 trillion of a opportunity, pretty big, that the banks just slay those money and that of a size of opportunity to be, you know, they don't pay attention to that kind of money and to that kind of, you know, numbers of people. How do you explain that?
It's not a lack of money. The problem is there's enough money in the world. It's a lack of
allocation. I'm talking about the size of the opportunity. Why do you think they still ignore it?
So they're not ignoring it in a way. And that's what always has troubled me. And and that's one of the things that, you know, corporations in its core, you know, there's not that one big vision really, right? You know, they're already profitable. At certain times they become comfortable.
They're 200 years old.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're trying, but it's a lack of, you know, having that, okay, I am there to solve this issue. And this is kind of in any industry. And that's why startups exist today, right? Because most startups and, you know, a lot of these startups are companies that are fixing problems or injustices in the world they see. And they're trying to kind of repair them and fix them. So for that reason, I see that the institutions, because, you know, they have their boards, their structures, their processes, they're just not that flexible and capable of, like, deciding, okay, we're going to do and change and really change this and fix this issue, because that's not their goal. Their goal is more about, their goal is only profit, right? They have, and that's the end goal of those large corporations versus, you know, the kind of the vision of the startups. And I'm not saying profit is bad. Profit is good. But when you kind of create structures and there's no right vision and there's no right strategy, it's just causing this. And this is kind of the same problem, because they just became too big and too robust and too inflexible of actually doing and solving concrete problems.
So walk us through your company and your product. How do you want to change this?
So fundamentally, and it's funny enough, but it is a huge, massive problem. And in a way, I probably cannot fix it totally alone. That's one thing. I can't do that by myself. So, and I need to get those institutions part of this process. And so for that reason, you know, being able to show a fundamentally exactly sustainable, efficient kind of business model that can work and, you know, kind of evaluate the risk of these SMEs, be more efficient at allocating capital, evaluating the risks more properly, using data, using AI, and using kind of all the information that is accessible today and technologies, then by that, I can kind of go and I can work with those banks potentially and actually serve that SME class. Because the one thing, as I said, it's not a money problem. The banks have more than enough money. It's a systematic lack of understanding and just lack of vision that's stopping that. But from a profitability basis, it could be really interesting for those institutions. So being able to work with them is a way to go forward.
Can you give us an example of a company that is not eligible by, you know, checking the boxes in the bank, but if you take the FlowPay approach, now you see that a company as a healthy business that is worth the trust of the loan?
So really importantly, traditionally, how banks evaluate small businesses is based on one main data source, and that is a tax return. We who are entrepreneurs or freelancers, you know, you put in our tax return once a year. It's a summarized information. And still till the end of now June, for example, if you have an auditor, you're still your only tax return available is from year 2023. That's absurd, right? You know, like if you go to a bank right now and you're giving them your tax return for 2023, that is a completely irrelevant data source. It's June 2025. So it's a completely irrelevant data source. It's a year and a half summarized information. First of all, and even if you were to be honestly putting everything as it's supposed to be, which is not the fact, 90% of all entrepreneurs optimize their tax returns. You know, they, and it's not only small businesses, even large banks. You have many examples of optimizations so they don't have to pay
taxes.
So taxes. And so, and they use these data is like your profitability as the source of calculating if you're eligible for a loan or you're not. And for me, that's completely absurd. That data is completely irrelevant. So for that reason, I believe, you know, accessing real-time data from different platforms or sources that they use to run their business. So if it's, for example, an e-shop, they have an e-commerce platform. If it's a restaurant, it has a point-of-sale system. Mm-hmm. Or if it's a carpenter we were talking about, they have a accounting software through which they issue invoices. You have the real-time data. And you don't have it a year-and-a-half-old data, or actually 2.5-year-old data, if you take it from the beginning of that 2023. But you literally have it what happened, what they did yesterday. And so being able to use this data, because, and this is why I also believe it's the right time that this problem can be solved, because there's enough money, there's enough data, so we can actually evaluate the businesses more efficiently.
You said that you think that the Czech Republic is great testing market, like a thermometer of the potential success. So what temperature do you think that the Czech market has right now?
So, one thing, not for every business. It depends on the type of business you're building. When it comes to financial products, I actually believe it's very good because we do have a strong banking system, but it's very conservative. Therefore, a massive opportunity in these financial services. And Czechs are also very conservative. So for them to be actually, and they trust their big companies. So for them to trust...
Financially,
exactly. So for them to trust smaller, companies, fintechs, is a proof of concept that if you are able to succeed on the Czech market, you can really kind of push through even in larger markets because they really that. So, and it also, there's partially a lack of competition. There's not that many services that you have to compete with which makes it kind of sometimes can make it difficult. So if you test it out, you verify, you build, you can then build a product that works, exists, and then you can scale it. And then you can compete in those markets, which are, let's say, bigger and more competitive.
You have a lot of foreign experience. Have you ever witnessed in any of your travels a banking system that would be less conservative than the one that you're experiencing at home?
So like a concept that did really inspire me was the Grameen banking concept in Bangladesh. So Muhammad Yunus, he actually received a Nobel Prize for this, and he created a concept which really I think is very interesting and takes inspiration. It's not really exactly what we're doing. It's very much microfinance, and it's in, let's say, third world countries, and it's more based on trust. But in a way, the concept shows how important trust plays in funding loans. So they created basically concept that you know, there's different, let's say if somebody takes a loan, that he has to get guarantors, but like people who, like a community that trusts mm-hmm. that person. And if that person, of course, defaults, then those other people can't take a loan as well. So it's kind of based on a trust basis.
And so it's the community providing the money?
No, it's this Grameen kind of mm-hmm. banking system. So it's kind of and funding them and supporting these communities. And it's mostly for entrepreneurs, smaller entrepreneurs starting. Now it's a lot more focused on women, but I think it's enough. I think 80 or plus countries around the world, this concept very much effective, and it really supports the lower income communities to be able to get mm-hmm. them out of, because they don't have a credit score. They're not able to, you know, evaluate mm-hmm. them because they don't fall into the check marks of these banks, but they're able to kind of build more on the trust basis. But it shows that if you give them the trust and you give them the capital, they're actually so grateful for it. They're more eligible, they repay more efficiently, and they actually, the defaults are very low, and they're very, and it's really important then for the economy, because the economy grows, the money kind of turns around and circulates, you know, and keeps going, which is, you know, that's the thing that small businesses, why they're so important is most of that money stays within the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And it really just keeps turning. So if there's more money in the economy, there's more, it just trickles down effectively. It's not like
chicken and egg.
Exactly. Right. It's not suddenly they're just going to sit in a pile of money, which corporations do, because the bigger they are, they plan 10 years ahead. So they just literally sit on money. But small businesses put it back in the economy. So, you know, there's a certain kind of misunderstanding of risk to small businesses, of how actually risky they are.
I hear you being pretty critical about the banking system, yet you need them as a partners to really change the situation. Would you ever consider having a bank in like letting them buy your equity, like having them as an investor or their CVC branch?
Good question. It really depends on how the CVC is set up, because not every CVC's goal is purely like, you know, believing in the project, supporting the project and letting it work alone. But it's right. A lot of CVC's goals is how can we get this product inside our bank?
A lot of startups want that and see the potential exit money like that.
Honestly, that kills the company. And my opinion is because you're mixing two different worlds mm-hmm. that can never work together. And for the startup, it becomes a limiter. And for the bank, it becomes a potential liability, and they will never align on the vision, because the banks don't have that same vision as that entrepreneur, and that can cause a lot of problems. They might exit. It might become, they will exit, but they will never build a truly big company. I have never seen examples of really CVCs investing into startups and being like with their goal of taking it into the bank of actually becoming super successful or mm-hmm. like, you know, really game changing. And this is maybe the question, of course, like I'm no, if somebody's trying to build a company and he just wants to make profit and, you know, sees a potential opportunity, and that's great. I said, I have no issue with profit. I want profit, but it's great for everybody if you make profit and that money gets reinvested. It always, again, the money turns, it just keeps turning. Mm-hmm. There are certain CVCs, which their goal is like, okay, the bank is just their LP, and their goal is like, you can work with the bank, but you don't have to. And if that kind of CVC would come on board, I would be willing to. And there is a few of those on the market, and there's examples of that historically. I can put, for example, ABN AMRO Ventures. Mm-hmm. ABN AMRO Ventures had that kind of structure, and they, for example, invested into Tink, which was an open banking provider, which exited for $2 billion to Visa. Great success. But the goal was never to put the company, invest into it, and put it into the bank. Yeah, they leveraged maybe some technology, but that was never the goal.
Yeah, I've checked the Revolut cap table and still no bank in there and no banking CVC. So if you want to surpass that, this is just an info for you. And speaking of the cap table, how difficult was you at the beginning of your journey to land the... I think you have Czech VCs, you have Depot Ventures, and you have Soulmate Ventures, right?
Yes.
How easy was to land those?
Ooh, not easy. It was always a process, right? So in general, kind of in the type of business I'm building, there's with financial product, like fintech, of course, you know, had a lot of amount of capital that's being invested is being invested into fintechs when it comes to startups. But when you're building a business that is working with lending, it's not really a VC favorite. You know, venture mm-hmm. capitalists don't really like it. The reason is for that is they don't understand that market. You know, they understand software. They understand, you know, mostly we'll say software. SaaS is their kind of what I feel that most VCs understand.
That might be changing now.
Yeah, well, you put a bit of AI, but it's an understanding of how much of AI they actually anything. Exactly how much of AI they actually understand. I can be very critical of VCs. I'm very critical of any gatekeepers. Let's put it this way, because I really kind of hope for that. You know, money should be kind of more accessible. But when it comes to this problem that, that they just have a lack of understanding. And for them, it's kind of something if they don't understand it or they don't feel comfortable, then it's not always you can get them on board. And there's very few specialized VCs, especially in Europe, mm-hmm. which understand lending and small businesses. There's a few in the US, but then again, they don't really invest in Europe that mm-hmm. much.
So it was pretty hard, you say.
Yes.
I was quite surprised because Soulmate Ventures is an impact fund, right? Do you consider your product, your company as a impact startup, impactful company?
100%. I really do. Like, as I said, you know, like at the core, they understood the fact and the problem because people in Soulmate Ventures were as well very much connected with, you know, they are themselves are entrepreneurs, they build companies, and they know how important, you know, small businesses are mm-hmm. to the economy. And, you know, it's not only about, you know, social impact, which this kind of partially as well is, but it's, you know, economic impact, right? So, and that can trickle down to everything, right? Because if SMEs become easier to access capital, can become more profitable, can grow, then they can actually focus on things such as the environment, sustainability, and so on and so forth. When you're kind of fighting day to day just to survive, you don't have time to think about that. That's even the same with people in third world countries, right? If they don't have, if they have problems just filling the basic needs of life, you know, the Maslow's pyramid of needs, then they don't have time to worry about if they're using plastic bags, if they're throwing things on the ground, you know, they don't care about that. It's the same thing goes with entrepreneurs, right? So like, if you want them to be more sustainable, really think about the environment, think about long-term sustainability, then they need to be healthy. And we're helping them
be
healthy.
Be sustainable to be sustainable, you say?
Exactly.
And did you have to, for your Czech investor, for your first investors, did you have to explain what the problem is, be like evangelist of the issue, or did they personally felt that as well?
I think everybody knows, because I said, this is a theme that has been talked about for decades. So everybody knows this is a problem. But nobody actually kind of really delve mm-hmm. deep into like, okay, how can we change this? How can we fix this problem? And that's fundamentally with all the people who've tried to attempt at solving this. They've never, like, I'm fundamentally, like, in love with the problem and I want to fix it. That's my passion and that's what I'm trying to do with Flowpay.
You just landed, or I think it's a few months old news, you just landed a 30 million from a private fund, a British one.
Yes.
Are the dealings different? I mean, like, is the due diligence, tea, meetings... Is it different when you compare Czech VCs versus a British one?
So I wouldn't call them, they're not really a VC, but they understand the problem because that's their niche, right? So they're basically Fosinar Capital, one of their largest debt providers in Europe and in the world. They have over 5 billion pounds or euros, I can't recall right now, under management. And they help companies similar to what Flowpay is doing and provide them with capital and debt mm-hmm. to be able to grow. And when, so they really understood basically what we're doing. But, you know, at the same time, even though it's a debt, it's actually harder almost than getting, you know, equity. Mm-hmm. Because equity at one point, you can just get equity based on an idea, right? You know, look at these kind of AI firms, you know, it's a hype, they have an idea, and then they do that. But when you're raising kind of debts from these kind of institutions, you actually have to have a functional business. You have to show that the money's going to come back. because they're not there to take high risk investing into 10 credit lines and getting one back, because they don't, because there's a fixed return. So they have to get that money back. So it's much more complex, but they understand the problem. But you have to prove, and you have to build an actual functional and existing business.
So the complexity is bigger, but the money talks is simpler. You say they more understand the problem because they are in the business.
You don't have to tell them like why this is important, or like why I need €1 billion in a shorter period of time, which I will need to be able actually to do that. So like 30 million is just the start. And they even know that they're even going into it. They're not going into to provide me with 30 million. They're ready to give me up to 200 million and then grow to 500, €1 billion, maybe not just them alone, but in cooperation with other funds or these banks that would come on board. But they know that the opportunity is there.
I don't have to explain that. If you want to be that be that big. Let's talk a bit about Techstars, because you went through the incubator, accelerator Techstars. Because for that, you had to change your headquarters. You had to, just on the paper, I know, but still you had to move that to Netherlands, because still the West understands Czech Republic and the CEE region as the Wild West. So the West understands it as a Wild East, geographical pun intended. But do you think that is fair? Or was it because of the reason that they still think that it is unsafe to be headquartered in Prague?
I don't think it's I don't think they'd say it's unsafe. But yeah, they're still kind of, they look through their fingers. Like, we love to say, oh, we live in Central Europe. Like, but you know, they still really much consider us Eastern Europe. You know, they don't take
Iron Curtain.
Yeah, they don't see a difference between Romania, Hungary, Czech Republic, Poland. You know, it's they take us basically the same. Maybe an arrogancy as well. That's one of those kind of the arrogancy of Western Europe or even America for that fact. And whether the issue was that basically Techstars itself can invest into certain jurisdictions, and they have about 40 jurisdictions, and they do, for example, have Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, you know, but they didn't have Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, you know, if we wanted to participate in one of the largest accelerators in the world, well, the two biggest is Techstars and Y Combinator, which we were the second Czech company in history, we had to kind of choose. We had to go to a different jurisdiction. So it was either take it or leave it. And we decided to go.
Sure. But do you still consider that to be fair? I mean, the criticism and what it is based on, or do you still think it's just stereotypically false?
I 100% think it's stereotypically false. One thing, you know, like if you look, so I would say it's not Techstars, because Techstars itself just didn't have a jurisdiction. Yeah. And we've already discussed that they would like to kind of expand to be able to kind of invest, but it's a process. But 100% in general, Western Europe has this issue. It's stereotypically false that they undervalue kind of, I'll take all these Eastern Europeans. But if I were to say myself personally, I believe the opportunity in Eastern Europe and Central and Eastern Europe is just 100 times bigger than in Western Europe. And I also think the founders coming from Central and Eastern Europe are just so much more capable. And not even the founders, but even the people that are working in those startups, the tech talent is just so much better. The only thing we're lacking, I mentioned, lack of capital. West is much more well-funded.
But you also say that the capital is here, so it's just like misdirected?
100% misdirected. The money is here. It's just like, it's as well, let's say, that the money is not trickling down from these, let's say, extremely wealthy, high net worth individuals that rather buy their third apartment, fifth apartment, or buy a house in Spain instead of basically reinvesting and supporting the local ecosystem. That is why I also believe, you know, and that's what I'm trying to kind of educate, let's say, the market is like, let's reinvest back into the ecosystem. So that's how I'm kind of supporting it, and why also kind of donating my time to the Czech FinTech Association, where I'm now kind of, we were working on a kind of a program that could help and really help move capital towards the right direction. Because the money's here, it's just not going the right direction. It's totally understandable. I kind of understand why. It's kind of an evolution, right? You know, venture capital also didn't evolve from day to day in Western Europe or in America it took time. You know, it first started in the US, then it was brought to Europe. It also took a certain period of time. But taking it as, you know, being able to invest into the ecosystems and kind of the lack of understanding is something that is still out there.
So it means that if you feel that you already participate in the fintech association, etc. So here, if you become filthy rich, very famous, very successful, you, instead of buying a villa in Spain with your private beach, you still promise to come back and help to grow the local ecosystem?
100%. Like I consider myself a serial entrepreneur. You know, FlowPay is my passion project, and it's probably one of the most, it is the most passionate project I've ever built, but it's not my first one or my last one. And I know that for a fact. And that's what I fundamentally believe, that I always want to support and help and reinvest into the kind of the ecosystem. It doesn't have to be just in the Czech Republic, but in general, I just want to believe and I want to invest into the startup ecosystem. And just supporting the new entrepreneurs coming up and about. And that's what I'm kind of doing with FlowPay, right? I'm supporting entrepreneurs. And if you think about it, SMEs, you know, all startups are SMEs anyhow. Not all SMEs are startups, but all startups start as SMEs. So they all fall under that thing. They're the same batch. They're the same people that need access to capital to grow. They needed more.
They maybe have a more like state support and state focus because of the important verticals they represent. But yes. Yep. By the way, do you sometimes feel some frustration of the valuation? We mentioned like there's a lot of capital here, but you know, it's misdirected, it's relocated elsewhere. But on the West, you see similar size businesses with of startups, but 10 times the valuation. Does it frustrate you to see all those Eastern European founders and companies that are healthy, are good, but they cannot grab the same amount of attention?
100%. This is like, I kind of always say, it's not only about the valuation, but it's about the amount of money they raise. That's like, right, that's where it comes to. So like, if I raise €1 million here in Czech Republic, a similar startup in the UK or in Germany or in France, or not take US, but like will raise 10 million, right? So like 10 times more. And this is something that is really a big problem in general here, because, you know, okay, the markets here are, let's say, smaller than Germany, UK or France. Yeah. So they, first of all, straight away need to go and expand into to these other markets. So with 10 times less capital, they not only cover their local markets, but straight away think about expanding to international markets and become that. So it's like, one thing is good, it actually creates efficient, strong, let's say, really businesses that are also resistant to what is going on in the market, because they can be just, they're just better at that, because a lot of these companies in the West, we've not raised any more capital, we're closing down the company. You know, they are really fixed on the raising more capital because that's how they sustain themselves. But in the beginning, you know, here the companies really build strong fundamentals, which are really, which can really be valuable, much more valuable and more sustainable in the long term. Of course, the issue is then once they do want to, when they build those fundamentals, they want to grow, they don't have that access. And then at a certain point, you know, it's all about money. It's only money. Money talks, right? So if you're a company that raises 10 million or you're a company that raises 100 million euros, probably the company that raises 100 million has much more probability of succeeding, because, you know, both of them have their fundamentals and they can just scale. And, you know, if you're acquiring market shares, you need to build better products, hire better talent. It's obvious, it is all the time, it is about that money. Like, if you want to pay the best programmers, and technically now working remote, like, okay, is it, even the programmer from here, from the Czech Republic, if he wants, I don't know, 20, 30,000 euros a month, because he's like super amazing, and then a US company can pay him, but a Czech startup can't, then of course he's going to go there and that talent is going to leave, right? Maybe he's going to work remotely, bring value to the company, but he's going to be working and building value for an American company, not for a Czech company. And so that's kind of, and that's why I want to bring more capital into the venture market, and being that and that.
That brings us back to that promise and to dedication to help with, to grow and nurture the local startup ecosystem, which we truly appreciate. And speaking of promises, there's another one. I think your wife promised you during her wedding vow that she promised you another startup.
She said she'll support me in another startup as well. So
I call that dedication, right? Yes. What is that going to be?
Oh, that's not, who knows? Who knows? That's not, I'm not even thinking about that right now, what I'm building, and it's a problem, and it's maybe going to be a lifelong problem that I'm going to be solving with Flowpay. But I believe that the size to what you can build it in the next few years is going to be sustainable. And then who knows? Yeah, I might go out to build other things, other problems that I might see issues with, but right now, my focus is 100% at what I'm doing with Flowpay. But I just know I can never probably work for somebody. I'll always be an entrepreneur.
Have you ever tried, though?
Yes, I have.
How was it?
So my last...
Employee.
Yeah, my last working experience...
was that the first and last?
It was probably not the first, but it was the last, because that was the last drop. It was when I was about 19 years old. I worked for Hard Rock Cafe here in the Czech Republic. They opened their retail store. Actually became like one of the best salesmen. All the Hard Rock Cafe representatives, not just in Europe, where I was number one, but globally, I was like number three.
Humble.
Didn't manage number one. I didn't beat, I think it was like Hong Kong and New York or something like that.
I would bet. Yeah.
But what really kind of the thing that kind of made me realize, you know, like, so I would always analyze. So, you know, they were sold t-shirts, how much they sold it, what their profit margin was. And my salary was that time like 17 or 18,000 crowns. And the bonus I got was like 5,000 crowns, today, 200 euros worth of like vouchers for like massages. And, you know, the amount of value, I was like, if they would have given me like 0.5% or 1%, I probably could have made 100,000 because 150,000 crowns in that given month, which would have been such a better motivation and, you know, being able to work and build on that. But hey, then again, I wouldn't have probably had that last drop of saying never again, I'm only going to be an entrepreneur.
And have you learned something for that, for your startup? Are you now, you know, giving your best salespeople a different kind of vouchers?
Well, 100%. Well, I always say you want the best people, you have to pay the best. So like for me, it's not about, of course, as I said, company and the profit needs to go there. But 100%, you have to reinvest into your team, into your company, into your people, and you have to have them to be happy. But you also have to have them being part on board with you, right? Like, I'm not looking for employees, I'm looking for partners. So that's what I kind of look at everybody in the business is like, we're all here together trying to solve that issue. So that's, and I think that's how companies should be built as well. Mm-hmm. And that's where most small businesses are built. You know, they're
not... Don't give vouchers to your best salespeople. Could be lesson number one, yeah.
That was probably good advice.
By the way, before you started this, you even worked for a family office, right?
So I started a bit of my own.
WJ Ventures?
Yes.
WJ Ventures. So how important is to diversify for you?
Well, 100%. That was kind of one of the things that I learned when my dad's business kind of bankrupted back in that day. My dad never really diversified. And that was kind of, you know, he was always great at what he was doing. But at a certain point, you know, the market, things around him, and he wouldn't properly diversify. It's not just about like what you're doing, which you, if you have something that you're good at and do that, you should focus on it. But it's also being able to diversify your investments, having, and that's why even, I think giving back is also investing into startups. Mm-hmm. So, right. And I believe that I want to invest and support other startups. And it's not only about giving advice, but it's also about giving capital, which I was saying about. And that's a form of diversification.
WJ Ventures, that is named after you, right?
Yes.
Touché, your name Dominic. It could be DJ, DJ Ventures. And you could really play some music with that. But, you know, playing music can be also a mistake. And I really like how you talk about the mistakes and how you embrace the failure, how you talk about that everybody should have some. And you very openly talk about yours. What is the biggest one that you experienced or that you personally had?
I fail every day. So I don't say, you know, there's so many mistakes. Like you fail, I fail, I make mistakes, I learn from them, I go on. Like one of the most important thing is it's not how many times you fall, but how many times you get back up. And that's something that I really believe in. And I just keep on going. And that's one of the most things, like, being, because a lot, I think even companies don't really fail. They fail because people give up. And if you don't give up and you really believe...
Or they have a bad business model.
Bad business model. That could possibly... but that's already started from the beginning. If, I mean, if it's a good business model, then it was supposed to... and it's a question if there is a bad business model. Because it depends if... there can be. It's very theoretical question, because it depends if you have a market or if it exists already, the similarity, mm-hmm. and somebody else fails at it, then if you're creating a new market, then yes, you can have a bad business model. But most businesses are built on, let's say, you're not building new markets, you're just building other markets, and you are not able to do that correctly. I wouldn't say I have one big, like, oh, I fucked up here so mm-hmm. bad, and I'll never do that, because I just have so.
You
many
would be in jail,
messed.
So yeah. Happy you're here.
I've messed up so many times in my life, and I will so many more times, having the self reflection, because mm-hmm. you know, being able to, as I said, you know, look at that, analyze it, what happened, what did I do wrong. How could I do it better next time? And if you keep doing that, you can continuously improve. And I believe we are humans, that we all continuously just evolve, change, and improve ourselves. And if we stay true to our kind of vision, and maybe now if I'm talking about it, that's maybe thing is, like, don't lose sight of who you are, like, in your vision and what you believe. And that was one of the maybe the biggest mistakes, where I lost the vision of who I am mm-hmm. and what I want to do. And I stopped liking the person I am, which happened in my kind of late 20s. And I decided, and that was kind of, I needed to change.
Were you already a startupist back then?
Not a startupist, but I did have a lot of investments in different companies and startups as well. But I didn't have my own startup at that time.
And what did you do when you felt like you were starting to lose yourself?
I reset myself. I looked back and really went back to my kind of core values.
How do you do that? Do you go backpacking for 2 months, or how do you reset?
How did I do that? I know it's a long process, so it doesn't take day to day.
I'm not just saying that because I see our lovely screensavers saying that, but you know, what helps you?
Kind of. Looking in your self and kind of having those internal conversations mm-hmm. and thinking about who you want to be and what you want to do, and that's kind of going back to that core.
One thing that really strikes me as interesting is that you say openly, and you mentioned that in this podcast as well, like, that difficult time when your family lost almost all their money. You really got into
all of the money.
All of the money. You got into a horrible situation that you didn't have money to buy food. How did this really horrible situation, like, I cannot imagine, because I've never been to this low point, but how did that not make you more risk averse? How did that, having this experience, how did you not then jump on the, you know, best paying safe job for you? Like, how did this experience make you more? Is that, like, you know, self-harm of some sort? Or how do you explain that?
I wouldn't call it self-harm. I don't think taking risks is self-harming. I just, I love what I do, so I don't take
extreme
anything.
Sports, yeah. Then. Extreme sports.
I don't like extreme sports. I'm very, like, safe of my, like, own body when it comes to...
You can't go extreme on every way.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. It's a good question. I've never really had a deep understanding, because if I look at my older brother, he, for example, is very is more risk averse, which is a good balance to me sometimes. So I am a risk taker, 100%. I'm a big risk taker but I also believe that if you believe in what you do and in that you're just following your passion and your personal beliefs, and as I said, being true to yourself. So, and if I'm true to myself, that's what I want to do, and I will do it. So I'll follow that. From that, and my family, you know, it's a good question. I am not really.
Let's do a catch up podcast in 2 years, and I'll be interested what you have to say. My last question, as it always is, please tell us the weirdest food you've ever eaten.
Before I get to that, I just had because it's still processing in my mind, so I wanted to say, because it's also not just and having I had a great, you know, support. You know, it's not just my father, you know, went through it, but I do want to mention that we wouldn't have done all of that and gone through it without my mother, who kind of, kind of really.
And the older brother. Older brother. Seemed to carry the weight a lot.
Exactly. So it was all of us kind of, you know, kind of being able to create a support for each other. And that kind of really helped. And yeah, I'm thankful for both of them for giving me so much, you know, and going, helping us in those hard times. But it made me who I am today. And I wouldn't be able to, let's say, not only fail, but also succeed without going through that. So I'm extremely grateful for it. You know, I don't, at certain points you would be like, oh, you know, blame somebody for those kind of wrongdoings. And that's kind of the self-reflection that it, you know, it's not always.
I haven't heard you blaming anyone in this whole situation, which I think is remarkable because it's very easy to blame somebody else on any one's misfortune. And I hear you, and I hear also, like, it's not just medium-sized companies, it's also the families who are the backbone of the society.
Yeah, I 100% believe that.
Still gonna push you on that last question.
What fruit?
No, food. Weird food. It can be durian, but, you know, let's not focus just on food.
Oh my God. These are such tricky questions. Like, I have to now think and dig deep. What was the weirdest food that I have ever eaten? I don't know. It's really, I have no idea.
And we will get back to you we're gonna do an edit and in the copy of this podcast. If you will ever try something really nasty, we will let you know, people. Thank you, Will, so much for being with us today. Thank you for your honesty, how you talk about your story and how you talk about how you view things on the market. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.